nation, Segra, Degra, congregation, and still the throngs they hasten to sing songs of race and reformation, once sung by the lungs of long dead masons. So if here's the place and now's the time, you run your race while I fast and pray for mine, and hunger for the days when I can release the image of my people, proud and free from the collective walls of imagination. But right now, North America's just a fucked up fancy restaurant, and I'm looking forward to the day when I can't get a reservation.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hello everyone, my name is Sheikh Hussein and you are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph's Campus Community Radio. So do have a nice day.
Hi, my name is Peter and I volunteer at CFRU because it's a space that really encourages creativity and expressing yourself.
My name is Stacy. I love discovering music that sounds good to me. All kinds of music.
I love the people, I love the atmosphere, and everyone loves radio, and you can tell.
If you love radio and would like to get involved, volunteer at CFRU. No previous experience is required, and we provide all the training. Check out our website at cfru.ca, or call Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Volunteering at CFRU breeds minds, breeds culture. So come on down.
It is no surprise that one of CFRU's longest-running and most popular programs is Clan na Gael. We feature 2 hours of the best Celtic music from around the world and around the corner. Listen on Sundays after the BBC World News at noon. Tune in and get your fill of fiddles, whistles, banjos, mandolins, barons, harps, flutes and wonderful voices. And of course, let's not forget everyone's favorite Celtic musical instrument, the bagpipes. Clan na Gael is the most bagpipe-friendly show on CFRU FM 93.3. Join me, John Fahey, on Sundays and start your own Celtic Kitchen Ceilidh.
VegFest Guelph is excited to announce our second annual VegFest on September 20th from 11 to 5 at the beautiful Goldie Mill and Guelph Youth Music Center. Join us for a day filled with engaging speakers, live music, a fun kids area, dozens of vendors and exhibitors, and of course lots of delicious vegan food. Come on down to VegFest, a physically accessible event happening September 20th from 11 to 5 at Goldie Mill and the Guelph Youth Music Center at 75 Cardigan Street.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So before the break, we had Zacchaeus Jackson with Invicta, amazing spoken word poem right there. And before that, we had, of course, Femi Kuti with Truth Don't Die. And we had, of course, what Obama didn't say in his African Union address. Needless to say, he didn't address colonialism or imperialism or any of that kind of stuff, because the United States perpetuates those things around the world today. You know, so really what we have to do, brothers and sisters, is fight against imperialism, however it manifests, wherever it manifests in the world, whether that's in Canada or North America or anywhere. And we have to stand in solidarity to do that. Now, where I'm going to go right now is actually I'm going to play a talk given by Max Blumenthal, who is a American journalist who's done a lot of work in Palestine. And he recently put out a book called The 51-Day War about the most recent Israeli attack and devastation of the Gaza Strip, which happened last year. And this is probably one of the most hard-hitting pieces of work that I've actually seen with regard to this. So I'm going to play his talk on this show right now. And all I can say is this is really powerful stuff. So, I mean, you really need to have a listen to this. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This is my first talk on my book tour, and it, you know, this couldn't be a better crowd. I've done three talks. This is my third talk here. My first one was for Republican Gomorrah. If you're interested in kind of the Origins of the Duggar Clan. You should pick it up. It's, you know, I've, the Republican primary starting, and it's such a freak show. I forgot, you know, that I used to, you know, cover it, and you know, it just makes me love being American because you know we're on the front row of the freak show right here, and it's, you know, I know Donald Trump just got fired by NBC, but he's, you know, he's still running for president, so we can be entertained, and yeah. And I thought I would come here for some better weather, but it looks like I've never heard people in Seattle complain about a lack of rain before. So I think, you know, we have some work to do on climate change. I'm not going to speak to you about a very amusing topic tonight. I'm going to talk to you about my book, The 51-Day War, which I wrote in about 51 days under extreme pressure from a publisher who thought it was important to get this story out. I wrote it after being in Israel-Palestine for over a month during the 51-day war, about a month, including 2 weeks in the Gaza Strip, which is a very difficult environment to work in, not just for safety reasons, but for so many other logistical reasons. And, you know, of course, it's most difficult for the people who, unlike me, can't leave the walled-off ghetto. I wrote this book to remember those who died during the war, all 2,200 of them, not just those who we think of as civilians. I wrote this book to honor the resistance of those who fought to defend their homes inside the Gaza Strip. And I wrote this book to expose the criminals who destroyed Gaza and who killed over 500 children, mostly killed in their homes, in their bedrooms at night. And I wrote this book to put on the record the true story of the war. When did this war start? How did it begin? Did it begin on July 8th, 2014, as we're told? No. We could all go all the way back to 1947, when the Nakba began in earnest, when 750,000 indigenous Palestinians were forced out of their homes, off their land, and a large percentage were pushed into the Gaza Strip, which is now today a warehouse for the surplus humanity, who are not welcome because they are considered a demographic threat, a threat to the ethnic purity of the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant. And so that is really the backdrop to this war, to every war that's been fought in and around Israel-Palestine. Did this war begin in 2005 when Israel began to withdraw its settlers from the Gaza Strip and then promptly laid siege to Gaza after annulling elections in which Hamas was democratically elected? That is another piece of understanding. That is another piece of context that we need to understand. After this disengagement, which was celebrated by liberals in the U.S., we saw war after war using disproportionate force in the Gaza Strip, using 2,000-pound fragmentation bombs against the Gaza Strip, tank shells, 155-millimeter howitzer shells against civilian homes, and a doctrine that Israel called the Dahiya Doctrine, named after a neighborhood it destroyed in South Beirut in the 2006 assault on Lebanon. A doctrine which aims to punish the civilian population in order to turn them against their political leadership. As Gadi Eisenkot, who is now the chief of staff of the Israeli army, said to the Israeli newspaper Yediot Aharonot, in the future, everyone in South Lebanon is Hassan Nasrallah, and who is the spiritual leader of Hezbollah, and everyone in the Gaza Strip is Khalid Mishal, who is the head of the Hamas Politburo. In other words, there's no distinction between civilians and political leadership or armed factions. And so that is the open stated doctrine of the Israeli military going into this conflict in the Gaza Strip last summer. And it was a war. it was a war between two very unbalanced, with extreme power imbalance. And I want to emphasize the backdrop to the war. The war did not begin in the Gaza Strip. It began about 10 kilometers from Hebron, at a intersection where three Jewish Israelis in the occupied West Bank were hitchhiking. They were kidnapped by two rogue Hamas operatives, two figures operating without orders from Hamas, on their own, in order, after the collapse of the peace process, in which Israel refused to release a final batch of Palestinian prisoners in order to continue the peace process. Apparently, they were kidnapped in order to spur a prisoner release by other means of some 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. The kidnapping attempt failed immediately when one of the Israeli teens attempted to phone the police, got on the phone with the police. The police had a recording. The police heard gunshots. The police heard celebratory singing from the two killers. And the police, less than 24 hours later, found the burned car with blood, DNA, and bullets inside. What they didn't do, after telling Netanyahu, after bringing the Shin Bet, Israel's General Security Service, into the investigation, was inform the Israeli public. Instead, the Israeli military issued a gag order on all journalists, which forbid journalists from even reporting the existence of a gag order, which prevented them from describing, from detailing the investigation. All Jewish Israelis and the rest of the world knew, including in Jewish communities in the U.S., which were compelled to participate in these solidarity displays for the three missing, supposedly missing teens, was that the teens were missing, that Hamas was responsible, and that they could be anywhere, which led to Operation Brother's Keeper, a massive military invasion of the West Bank, including West Bank cities that had not been invaded since the Second Intifada. Hundreds of Hamas members and leaders, political leadership, were arrested. Palestinian prisoners who had been released under the Gilad Shalit prisoner swap were rearrested. And this was all a pretext for dismantling whatever infrastructure of Hamas and opposition to the Palestinian Authority, which went along with this entire operation and assisted it with its U.S. trained security services, was remaining. So you have Israeli troops rampaging through the West Bank in the Gaza Strip, where Hamas maintains power. They're looking at this as an act of war, as their leadership is being arrested without charges, on administrative detention, thrown in jail, sometimes tortured. The teens are discovered 2 weeks after they were kidnapped kidnapped on June 12, 2014. They're discovered, and an Israeli public which had thought that they were missing learns that they were dead. They are found in a shallow grave on the property of the suspects, whose families had been interrogated 24 hours after the kidnapping. How did Israel not find these teens who were in a shallow grave on this property with all their advanced satellite systems, all of their monitoring capabilities in the West Bank and their collaborator networks? They were found by volunteer Jewish Israeli hikers. Very confusing. It's almost like a deception was underway. They were found, and the Jewish Israeli public erupted in outrage and anger and in indignation. Netanyahu appears before his cabinet and he declares, "Vengeance for the blood of a small child, even Satan has not yet created." He explicitly calls for blood vengeance for these three teens, quoting from a 1908 poem by the Hebrew poet Haim Bialik, referring to and describing a pogrom against the Jewish population of Kishinev, in the Pale of Settlement, where my family comes from. So he's telling the Jewish Israeli public that they are victims of a pogrom committed by Palestinians who are no different from the rampaging anti-Semites of Europe. Within less than 24 hours, mobs erupt in Jerusalem, in central Jerusalem, declaring death to Arabs. That was their chant. Mevet le'aravim. That was the cry that Netanyahu inspired, and he inspired the killing of Mohammed Abu Khader, a 15-year-old Palestinian boy from the occupied neighborhood of Shufat in East Jerusalem, kidnapped by Jewish Israeli fanatics on his own property, forced to drink gasoline, and burned alive. This was the response. This was a warning to the Israeli government. It was a signal to the Israeli government that you either act or the situation will intensify and grow out of control. So Netanyahu redirects the situation to Gaza after declaring all of Hamas is responsible, when in fact there were no orders from Hamas for this kidnapping. The war that we're going to hear about is said to have begun on July 8th. It actually began on July 7th, so it's a 51-day war, not a 50-day war. It was on July 7th that Netanyahu and his defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, authorized airstrikes on Hamas positions in Gaza. Seven figures from Hamas's armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, were killed. So after watching Operation Brothers Keeper go down in the West Bank, then after these assassinations, Hamas decides to go to war and authorizes launches of long-range rockets, which carry very little explosive capacity but do psychological damage. My colleague and friend Allison Degger, who was in Shufat the night of July 8th, remembers an M-75 rocket sailing overhead from Gaza. As air raid sirens went off, she stood with the cousins of Mohammed Abu Khudair, the boy who was burned alive. One of them held her hand and said, "That rocket's for Mohammed." And that's how it was understood, as an act of resistance and an act of vengeance. And so the war began. Within days, on July 12th, the Israeli forces authorized a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip. Troops rumbled into the neighborhood, the city of Shujaiya, which is a neighborhood east of Gaza City, which lays hard against Israel's border areas. These troops were unprepared for any confrontation. Some of them entered in armored personnel carriers, which were actually 1960s era American Vietnam War relics. What they didn't know was that the Gaza Strip and the Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, was undergoing a process of military advancement. For years, this faction had been identified with suicide bombing and attacks on Israeli civilians. And that was an example of their weakness, their military weakness. They didn't possess guns. They didn't possess the kind of weaponry that could compete with the Israeli military. And so the choice was to respond by attacking soft targets, Israeli civilians. That strategy changed under the leadership of Mohammed Deif, who is the fifth leader of the Al-Qassam Brigades. All of his predecessors have been assassinated, and he has nearly been killed four times, is severely handicapped from the four assassination attempts. His partner in the militarization process, Ahmed Jabari, was killed in Operation Pillar of Cloud in 2012 in an assassination. What they did was create a network of tunnels underneath the Gaza Strip, largely for defensive purposes, and plan to fight the Israeli military head-on, as Hezbollah did in South Lebanon. The Israeli military failed to take a signal and failed to understand that the Al-Qassam Brigades could compete with it, even after a frogman team from the Al-Qassam Brigades swam into the ocean, into Israeli territory, stormed into an Israeli military base, and actually laid explosive charges on an Israeli tank. This was at Zikim, which is a kibbutz. They could have easily entered the kibbutz and killed scores of civilians, but they chose to attack military targets. Then, as they attempted to get in back to the sea, they were killed by drones. It was basically a suicide mission. The Israeli military covered up what happened there, and it was only leaked later on. The Israeli military failed to tell the public that it had lost a battle during an initial amphibious assault on the Gaza neighborhood of Sudania, which was repelled by the Al-Qassam Brigades. And so when they entered Shujaiya, the first real battle of the war, these armored personnel carriers came under attack by sapper teams, who often ran up to them and planted explosive charges on the armored vehicles by hand. One was completely destroyed. An Israeli soldier was taken alive after seven or eight were killed, and the Israeli military went berserk. Meanwhile,
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So we're playing Max Blumenthal's talk on the 51-Day War. His book, which is about his book on the Israeli attack on Gaza of last year. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Its soldiers came under attack from snipers. It came under attack from infantry, and just a general sense of panic fell through the ranks of the Israeli military. Back in Tel Aviv, Central Command ordered all troops to retreat into heavily armored modern Israeli armored personnel carriers, pull back, and the entire area of Shujaiya was blanketed with 155mm howitzer shells, 2,000-pound fragmentation bombs, and within some 24 hours, an entire city was completely gone. This was Israel's response to losing a battle. So, at this point, and then this was ignored, I mean, I really want to emphasize that the Al-Qassam Brigades of Hamas was fighting under a different doctrine than the Israeli military. Mohammed Deif and his spokesman, Abu Obeida, went on into international media, was never relayed to the American public, and mocked the Israeli military for attacking civilians and said, "We won't attack civilians. Our fight is with your soldiers," which is why some 75 Israeli soldiers were killed during this conflict. Five Israeli civilians were killed, including one child, Daniel Traegerman. And everyone knows Daniel Traegerman's name, but nobody can name one of the over 500 children in Gaza who were killed. In Shujaiya, during a seven-day ceasefire, I met the Attash family, which was lucky enough to have lived through a night of hell, a massacre which left over 150 people dead. They lived because the 1,000-pound Mark 82 dumb bomb, which was lodged into their ceiling, failed to explode. And the day before I met them, it was disarmed by a bomb disposal expert. I met the family of Salem Shemali the same day in Gaza City. Their home was completely destroyed. Much of their family was killed, including several members in execution-style killings who I met in the ruins of their home. And I met this family because their son, Salem, had gone looking for them, 19-year-old Salem, with a group from the International Solidarity Movement. Salem was wearing a green shirt and jeans, and he wandered into a street where his family lived and called out for them and suddenly fell to the ground. He was shot once, and the International Solidarity Movement volunteers who were with him filmed him. Then he called out again, and he was shot again and crumpled to the ground, and then finally an Israeli sniper finished him off on camera. Many of you saw this killing or heard about it. It was actually reported by my friend Ayman Moaldin from NBC before he was strangely reassigned. I found a map in the rubble of Shujaiya, which is reproduced in my book. It was an Israeli military map that I found in an empty ammunition box. And this map contained markings in Hebrew that I didn't fully understand until I went to Brussels to participate in the Russell Tribunal, which is a people's tribunal on war crimes in Gaza, and spoke to my friend Eran Efrati, who is a former Israeli combat soldier who participated in the attack on Gaza in 2008-2009. And I pointed to him a line which was labeled in Hebrew, Hardufim, and he said Hardufim means dead people. And it's what is traditionally called out on Israeli military radios when there's an Israeli casualty. So that could be for evacuating casualties, but it's also what we were given, the command we were given in 2008-2009 when a free fire zone was created and we could open fire on civilians. Iran had actually interviewed three soldiers who participated in the Battle of Shujaiya and who had direct knowledge of the killing of Salem Shemali, and they said that a red line was established, and they were told that if anyone crosses this line, shoot them. Salem Shemali had crossed that line, and his home fit neatly into the area beyond the Hardufim line. This is what the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem called an open fire policy. So these killings were no accident. These were war crimes that deserved to be punished. And they happened across the Gaza Strip in Hosea, which is a farming village, again, in the buffers, on the border with Israel. You know, they live in a very tough neighborhood in Gaza because they're next to Israel. I met survivors of 9 days of pure hell. I felt like I wandered into a window in hell in this farming village where the Ibad al-Rahman Mosque had been detonated by Israeli soldiers with C4, who declared that they were getting revenge for their dead comrades, where the main water tower had been destroyed, where almost every single house was either badly damaged or completely destroyed, and where people were walking around like ghosts, still in trauma during the war. It was there that I walked into the home of Hani al-Najjar, who was a nurse in the nearby city of Khan Yunis. He took me into his bathroom and was attempting to explain to me why he wanted to destroy his own home, which was still intact. In his bathroom, I found walls caked with human flesh, hair, and blood, and on the floor I saw grenade pins and bullets. 6 men had been bound and executed in his bathroom, and 1 in his child's room. Many of his family members were currently being held in Israeli prisons. They had been taken for interrogations, which often lead to torture. Just around the street, I met the Rujela family, who had lived, all except for 1. They told me about their daughter, Khadir Rujela, 19-year-old, severely disabled girl who could only move in a wheelchair. They attempted to escape from the town, which was surrounded by an Israeli tank division. And when the Israelis began firing on them, they fled and realized they had left their daughter, Fadir. She was found feet in front of her wheelchair about a week later, badly decomposed. The International Committee of the Red Cross was unable to retrieve her at any point or even enter the town. And in many ways, they were unwilling to attempt to do so, and they may deserve to be exposed as well. I later met 2 paramedics from the International Red Crescent, Ahmed Awad and Alaa Al-Kusofi, who had gone into Hosea during the time that it was under siege by the Israeli military, who did so out of conviction as Palestinians in Gaza, but also because they were asked to retrieve a man who had been lashed to a tree by Israeli soldiers and was apparently bleeding to death. He had been shot in his leg. They arrived. The Israeli soldiers told their colleague, Mohammed Abadla, to get out of the ambulance. They told him to walk a few steps forward, hold up a lighter over his head, and then they shot him in the chest. And so these 2 men described to me watching their colleague executed in front of them. I couldn't believe it. But recently I spoke at Princeton University and heard about this from someone in the audience. And I said, "What is your name?" He said, my family is Abadla." I keep having this story confirmed time and time again. Another story of a crime that's going unpunished. In Hosea, I found Stars of David spray painted on the walls of a school for women that was funded by USAID. And in the principal's office, I found weapons. I found weapons being stored in the principal's office. These were weapons produced by Nammo Arms, a Norwegian-owned arms company, which produces them out of Phoenix, Arizona. They are anti-tank, light anti-tank weapons, which were used by the Israeli military against civilian targets in Hosea. So these were the weapons I found being stored in civilian areas, along with the abuse of the symbol of the Jewish religion projected to the people of the Gaza Strip as a symbol of hate, as a symbol of death, as a symbol of everything that's the opposite of what I know it as. And I saw it again and again and again in destroyed homes and schools. In Beit Hanun, another area on the border of Israel to the north, which was destroyed without reason, after most of its residents, if not all, evacuated. I met Abu Rahman, who is the neighbor of the Wahadan family, and he told me how this family had been held in their home on July 17th. While the rest of the village fled, the Israeli soldiers sorted them out. They divided them between the men who were of military age, took them in armored personnel carriers to Israeli prisons for interrogation and possible torture, and kept everyone from two-year-old Rena to her grandparents in the house. A week later, when it appeared that a ceasefire was underway, the Israeli soldiers ordered them to remain in the house, then called in artillery strikes on the entire neighborhood, and within 1 hour, the entire neighborhood was destroyed. There's video of it. As I spoke to Abu Rahman, young men were in the rubble of the Wahadan family home looking for the remaining body parts of two-year-old Henna and her aunt, 52-year-old Baghdad. The rest of the family had been found, parts of them at least. And as Abu Rahman told me how Israeli soldiers, the Israeli military had destroyed his olive trees, they had destroyed his home, his apiary, his business, and destroyed his neighbor's home, a man approached me with a bunch of grapes and a bottle of cold water. The character of the people I met in the Gaza Strip was impeccable. And if I ever faced any threat as a Jewish journalist, it was from eating too much sugar, the threat of tooth decay, as people handed me candy and sweets everywhere I went in the rubble, in the destroyed homes that they used to live in. The United States, the Obama administration, at every step of the way obstructed diplomacy. We have to remember that at the onset of the war, the conditions that Hamas offered for a 10-year truce with Israel were entirely humanitarian in nature. They wanted a seaport. They wanted they wanted to be able to rebuild the airport that had been destroyed. They wanted permits for people to be able to go pray at Al-Aqsa during Ramadan. They wanted a basic standard of living that we all take for granted. That's what they went to war for. And John Kerry rejected all of these terms, aligning himself with the military junta in Egypt, which rose to power through a coup and a sham election, which is currently holding some 40,000 people in prison, aligning himself with them, the Palestinian Authority, and the Israelis to hold Gaza in a vice. This extended the war to 51 days. And right after the assault on Shujaiya, Barack Obama and the Obama administration authorized Israel to dip into an emergency surplus of weapons that the Pentagon keeps in Israel to allow it to replenish its supplies of mortars and howitzer rounds. What were they going to do with that except destroy more civilian homes?
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, playing Max Blumenthal's talk on his book, The 51-Day War, about the Israeli assault on Gaza. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
On August 1st, during what appeared to be the beginning of a humanitarian ceasefire, John Kerry oversaw a deal that Hamas didn't participate in. So they were unaware that Israel thought that it was able to continue operating in the Gaza Strip while a humanitarian ceasefire was taking place. A unit from the Israeli Army's Givati Brigade entered the eastern region of the southern town of Rafah in the Gaza Strip and took over a home. They were attacked by a unit from the Al-Qassam Brigades with RPG rounds and light weapons. This unit emerged from a tunnel. Two soldiers were killed, and one, Hadar Golden, who happens to be the second cousin once removed of the Israeli defense minister, one of the golden sons of Israel, was taken through the tunnel shaft. The Al-Qassam Brigade's goal was to kidnap soldiers in order to spur prisoner swaps. They take him. Barack Obama appears on national TV and blames Hamas for breaking the ceasefire, when in fact Israel was operating militarily still inside the Gaza Strip in an offensive capacity, giving Israel all of the political space it needed to invoke the Hannibal Directive. What is the Hannibal Directive? It's a chilling name for a military doctrine. It's a semi-secret military doctrine adopted in 1986 by the Israeli military after the Jibril Agreement, in which Israel traded, released over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners to get two of its own back, I think. It was the point of the Hannibal Directive is to prevent prisoner swaps by allowing the Israeli military to attack kidnapping teams and to kill any Israeli who might be kidnapped in places like the Gaza Strip. So it's a doctrine that allows the Israeli army to kill Israelis when, of course, the parents of those soldiers or those Israelis would want them alive. They would want the prisoner swap as Gilad Shalit's parents did. When the Hannibal Directive was enacted in Rafah, it led to the destruction of entire neighborhoods. I visited this area and found shards of MK-82 dumb bombs, shards of drone missiles, artillery and broken pieces of mortars were simply in the street. You couldn't walk down the street without noticing them. Over 100 people were killed, maybe over 120, when the Givati Brigade enacted the Hannibal Directive. It was used not just to attack the ambush team, but as a mechanism for revenge against the entire area of eastern Rafah. Families like the Kadan family, which I interviewed, fled to the only, what seemed like the only safe place, the Al-Najjar Hospital, which was the only functioning hospital in Rafah at the time. As soon as they arrived, the Israeli military phoned in their intention to bomb the hospital. And so all of the dead, the wounded, the doctors, the medical staff came pouring out of the hospital. And the dead and the wounded had to be transferred to a tiny dental clinic in the center of Rafah called Al-Kuwaiti Hospital, which was run by a single doctor who I interviewed, Samir Holmes, who was used to tending to older women. It was a gynecological and dental clinic, or giving kids their dental checkup. He found himself performing emergency amputations on bodies on the floors in dental chairs. He found his nurse, one of his nurses, come in a body bag with her body separated from itself, and he had to revive his staff when they fainted after seeing one of their colleagues bisected in such a way. The carnage became so bad that Holmes had to call local shops and bring in ice cream coolers in order to store the bodies of infants. This was, I think, the image of the war. A group of five or six infants in death shrouds stored in an ice cream cooler. They should have been eating ice cream. Ofer Winter was the commander of the Givati Brigade that oversaw the Hannibal Directive. Ofer Winter is one of the most popular figures in Israeli society, and he exemplifies the new breed of religious nationalist soldiers who are moving into the Israeli officer corps and are taking over Israeli society at every level, from the intelligence services to the Knesset to the Israeli government. Ofer Winter believed, and he told in an August 15th interview with Yediot Aharonot, the Israeli newspaper, he said that we were protected by clouds of divine honor when we were attacking Rafah. And then he boasted, we shredded them. He declared, in almost every home, there is a son or other relative that is a partner in terror. And so he admitted that he drew no distinction between civilians and military personnel. Ofer Winter was expressing the sensibility that was also expressed at the time by Knesset member Ayelet Shaked, who said that Palestinian mothers had to be killed before they gave birth to, in her words, little snakes. The mentality of Naftali Bennett, then the economics minister, who declared that the people of Gaza were committing self-genocide. In the current government, Ayelet Shaked is the Minister of Justice, and Naftali Bennett is the Education Minister in charge of designing educational curricula for students. What kind of mentality will they breed? These young, popular religious nationalist leaders. By August 14th, after the Israeli military pulled out of Gaza, by its own estimate, it had fired 3 million bullets, which is about almost two for everyone living in the Gaza Strip. Over 3,000 tons of ammunition were deployed in this tiny area, which is one of the three most densely populated areas on Earth. 25,000 tank shells were fired into the Gaza Strip. 18,000 homes had been destroyed. Over 400 businesses and factories had been destroyed. At this point, over 100,000 people were homeless, and scabies was spreading through UN shelters. Hamza Abu Murad, the chief of the Gaza Strip's bomb disposal team, who would himself be killed while attempting to dismantle a missile, estimated that actually 18,000 tons of explosives were used against the Gaza Strip, which is 5,000 more tons than were contained in one of the bombs the United States dropped on Hiroshima in World War II. 89 families were wiped from the civil record in the Gaza Strip. 89 families. An Associated Press investigation found that of the 2,200 people who were killed, nearly 900 were killed at home, at night, in their own homes, by precision-guided Israeli weapons. That's 89% of them were civilians. So if you think about the 800,000 or so olive trees which have been uprooted by the Israeli military since 1967, think of the family trees that were uprooted in this attack on the Gaza Strip last summer. Think about that. Think about what kind of crime that is. I want to take you to the end of the war. The war transformed into a kind of air war with the Israeli Air Force, its Hermes 450 and Hermes 900 weaponized drones, bombarding the Gaza Strip every night. And, you know, to withstand those bombardments for me for just a few nights was nearly impossible. No matter how much Ambien I took, I couldn't sleep. It was just simply terrifying to hear the jarring sound of explosives crashing into a house and wonder who had died. I was sitting at a cafe interviewing the camp breakers, who are the first crew of breakdancers in the Gaza Strip, and they were telling me how they brought breakdancing to Gaza. I hear a massive airstrike nearby. Not directly nearby, but in an adjacent neighborhood. It was in the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood. And then another bomb, and then another bomb. And that night I find out that Israel had targeted Mohammed Deif once again, the leader of the Al-Qassam Brigades, with GBU bunker buster bombs, which were given to Israel, ostensibly to attack Iranian nuclear facilities or heavily fortified areas, but instead to attack the home of the military leader of Hamas, who survived. Again, this was an embarrassment to Netanyahu that Deif had survived. Abu Obeida, al-Qassam's spokesman, appears on TV to mock Netanyahu, and so he targets the three of the most popular figures within Hamas's military wing, Raed Attar, Mohammed Abu Shimaleh, and Mohammed Barhum, and Rafa, and succeeds. How did the Israeli military know that Deif would be in this home? Deif is not his real name. Deif in Arabic, I think, means guest. And he's called guest because he's always a guest in someone's home. He's like, you know, the ultimate couch surfer, because he's always on the run for his life. All of these guys are underground. How did they know? It's because every neighborhood in the Gaza Strip is honeycombed with collaborators or informants for the Israeli military. Why are they informing the Israeli military? Why are they committing an act of treason, which we consider treason to be something that's so rare? Because they're desperate. And because they're constantly preyed upon by Unit 8200, which is Israel's version of the NSA, is actually the largest unit within the Israeli military. It consists of the best and brightest of Israeli society, its most educated members. And their job, or one of their jobs, is to find collaborators by listening to cell phone calls, identifying who's weak, identifying those who need medical treatment, identifying those who are having an affair, identifying those who are homosexual. Listen to the words of one of the refusers from 8200 who protested the war crimes that he had participated in after the war and was summarily punished by his government. If you're homosexual and know someone who knows a wanted person, Israel will make your life miserable. If you need emergency medical treatment in Israel, the West Bank, or abroad, we searched for you. If you interest 8200 and don't have anything to do with any hostile activity, you're still an objective. So tell that to Mayor Ed Murray the next time he goes on a pink washing tour. The Israeli military targets homosexuals and destroys their lives. And these people who were induced into collaborating against their neighbors, some of them were caught. And after these assassinations, some of those who were caught or accused were brought into a public yard in the Gaza Strip and executed. A scene that Benjamin Netanyahu has used to conflate Hamas with ISIS. But we need to understand the background of this ghastly display and the tragedy behind it, the tragedy that lurks in almost every home in the Gaza Strip, and the paranoia that consumes Gazan society. The war ended with Israel deliberately targeting a series of civilian residential towers and a shopping mall with airstrikes, first bringing down Zafar 4, which is a residential tower in the center of Gaza City that's home to the elite of Gaza, the middle class, the engineers, the doctors, the athletes, those who have nothing to do with the conflict. That was why it was targeted. And so some 40 families were left homeless after being evacuated and watching their building and their lives destroyed by Israeli F-16s. Later, a few hours later, the Italian compound, another large residential tower built by an Italian businessman in the 1960s for Gaza's middle class, its professional class, was brought down by Israeli F-16s, and over 50 families saw their livelihoods, their homes, their memories eradicated.
Listening to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and playing Max Blumenthal's talk on his book, The 51-Day War on the Israeli Attack on Gaza. So please stay tuned to Back in USSR.
The Basha Tower, which is home to all of the media offices of the Gaza Strip, including the office that Bloomberg News uses to when it works in the Gaza Strip, was brought down in the same fashion by Israeli F-16s. It's as if the CNN Tower in Atlanta were brought down, or the Thomson Reuters building in New York were brought down. It's as if a media outlet in Paris were attacked by terrorists for no reason at all. But unlike that attack, no one said, "Je suis Gaza." In fact, they listened to Netanyahu, our government, when he said that he was attacking terror towers. In fact, he was enacting the Dahiya doctrine of attacking civilians to turn them against their government. Attacking the soft heart of Gaza that had never faced this attack before. And these were where many of my friends lived. I mean, I can't describe to you the kind of terror and the trauma that they experienced, wondering if they would be next. And so the U.S. watched as its, what Barack Obama called its unshakable ally, brought one civilian tower after another down. We should have solidarity with those who lose their towers. But I guess some people don't fit into our frame. With the war over and a ceasefire that guaranteed nothing to the Gaza Strip and which left the status quo in place, the civilian population in the Gaza Strip was left to wonder whether it was worth it, while the Israeli public turned further to the right wing as figures like Naftali Bennett promised that in the next war, he would lead Israeli troops into the heart of Gaza City and would overthrow Hamas and reinstitute a direct occupation. And my book ends, and you know, this talk is going to end here, with a portrait of a teacher who's a friend of mine named Rifat Alarir. I spoke at Bellingham last year And Rifat spoke there. He actually managed to get a permit for once a week after me. When I spoke there at Western Washington University, the students, a lot of them had never heard about Israel-Palestine before, especially presented in this way. And they approached me with curiosity, including a young Jewish student who was asking me, just bombarding me with questions. When Rifat spoke a week later, along with two other writers from the Gaza Strip, that Jewish student, who is just starting to unpack this for the first time, cried openly throughout the entire talk. And now I've been told he's a leader in the burgeoning Palestine solidarity movement on that campus. Rifat had told me that he had never spent time with Jews before he was able to travel across the U.S., and that he came to a point earlier in his life as a literature professor at Islamic University, which was founded in 1976 by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the spiritual leader and founder of Hamas, that he had his Malcolm X moment. Like Malcolm X, who in prison was asked by a member of the Nation of Islam, think about all of the white people you've ever met in your life. How many of them have you had positive experiences with? And Malcolm X, then Malcolm Little, thought, well, all of them have abused me or harmed me in one way or another. And Rifat had had that experience with Jews, that he had never met a Jew who had done anything to him but harm. That is the experience of so many young people in the Gaza Strip growing up under siege who don't even meet Israelis unless those Israelis come to them as faceless killers, either in drones or tanks or pointing guns at them. Rifat was already finding his way out of what many Americans would consider to be an anti-Semitic mentality when he came to the U.S., but it was his ability to live with Jews and to meet them here, to meet people like those who hosted his tour from Jewish Voice for Peace, that he was able to formulate a clear narrative and distance anti-Zionism and distance Judaism from Zionism. When he returned to the Gaza Strip, he attempted to inculcate his students in this mentality to help them understand that there was a life beyond this binary, this polarized world that they've been trapped in. He started to teach them about the poetry of the Hebrew poet and writer Yehuda Amichai, who's an Israeli, and he began teaching them The Merchant of Venice, about a Jew placed into impossible conditions by an apartheid-like regime. And at the end of his class, he asked his students, who do you identify with more, Othello, the Venetian general of Arab origin, or Shylock, the Jew? And each one of them, every single one of them, declared that they identified with Shylock. He said it was his proudest day as a teacher. Unfortunately, those papers that his students turned in on The Merchant of Venice were burned when the Israeli military bombed Islamic University and bombed Rifat's office on August 2nd. And his students joked that they were guilty of producing PMDs, or poems of mass destruction. I'll read you an excerpt from one of those students' papers in which she paraphrased Shylock's famous cri de coeur, his famous soliloquy. Hath not a Palestinian eyes? Hath not a Palestinian hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian or Jew is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? Like the medieval European ghetto masters, our government has decided that the lives of this racial outclass warehoused in Gaza do not matter, that they have not eyes, organs, hands, and that they do not bleed as we do. Otherwise, the policy would not be to resupply the state that's destroying them, occupying them, and besieging them. Otherwise, there would not be an initiative in Congress to increase Israel's annual aid from $3 billion a year to $4.5 billion a year. Otherwise, at least one home out of the 18,000 that were destroyed would have been rebuilt. But a year later, Gaza still lies in ruins. This isn't a complicated situation. Don't let anyone complicate it for you. It's not about good and evil. There's good and evil on both sides. This is about justice versus injustice. It's about basic fairness. It's about basic human decency. That's all this is about. And so it's not enough for me as a journalist to bear witness. It's not enough for me to simply tell you the facts on the ground. It's not enough for you to simply buy this book. And it's not enough to give Gaza your charity. I'll end with the words of Raed Bakr, who is the captain of a fishing boat in Gaza, and his answer to my question, what can we Americans do? Our message is simple, he said. We don't need any aid or anything. Just put pressure on the Israelis so they get out of the sea and let us fish and bring a livelihood to our families again. Thanks.
All right, we have about 20 minutes for Q&A. I'd like to remind folks to come up to the mics on either side of the stage so that we can all hear you. And as Edward mentioned at the beginning, if you could please keep your questions brief and in the form of a question. Thank you.
Max, we depend on you now for knowing what the situation is and how it's changing. How would you contrast what you reported in Goliath with the situation in Gaza and in the West Bank as it exists now?
Thanks. I think the situation is even worse than it was when I finished writing Goliath. But Goliath explains the political and psychological foundation of this war, which brought to bear the full malevolent fury of Israel and its violent capacity against the civilian population in Gaza. And my book explains how that was possible and how a population like Jewish Israeli society could support the war at a level of 95% at its height, with over 45% declaring that the Israeli army had not used enough force. Goliath is a portrait of an active settler colonial society entering into a terminal phase, in which it's unable to vanquish the indigenous population or obliterate it through genocide as the United States did. And it's simply acting out in frustration without any clear solution or strategy. Meanwhile, you have young people, Jewish Israeli youth, who are being heavily indoctrinated into the most comprehensively militarized society on earth. They're told the whole world is against them. They're told the second Holocaust could happen at any time. And they're told that the base of evil is in the Gaza Strip, and that they embody the spirit of Hitler. And I'm not exaggerating. Netanyahu told the entire faculty all the classes at Bar-Ilan University in October 2013 that the Palestinian National Movement embodies the spirit of the Third Reich. And that's his language. And so you're growing up learning that. You're being sent into the military at age 18, and you have to interact with Palestinians on this basis, where the only way you can interact with them is as an occupier. What does that do to your mentality? What kind of society is that producing? It produces a society that's capable of doing what it did in Gaza. And I think I've said it a million times, but I'll say it again, because I think there's victims on both sides. Zionism is a prison for Palestinian bodies and Jewish minds. And these are the Jewish minds who need to be liberated. And JVP is on, I think, a rescue mission for these Jewish minds. So I'm proud to be involved in this event with them.
So as part of the American voting public, how can we... You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, and this is The Underground. I'm Audiophile, covering for DJ Vulgar. I hope you enjoy.